Why do this topic, emotional intelligence and leadership? Maybe it sounds a bit warm and fuzzy, a bit Bible-like, a bit kind of psychobabble. I think that there is something useful here for us as leaders, and everything that's sanctified by the word of God and prayer, we can take, can't we, as believers? It all belongs to us. So because we believe in common grace, we can absorb some of the helpful things from our world and apply it. But obviously, this isn't strictly scripture. It's not the Holy Spirit. It's not spiritual gifts. But I think there are some useful skills here for us. And we can put these things within a biblical framework and use them. And there are common grace insights because we live in God's world, don't we? God has made it. God has made the world with invisible laws and rules, and wisdom is about understanding that. And I think actually there's a lot more relevance here with regard to godliness and character than we might necessarily think. You see, while good emotional intelligence is not the same as godliness, and poor emotional intelligence is not the same as sin, because you know, unbelievers can have high emotional intelligence and believers can have low emotional intelligence. It is actually still relevant for character, because I think emotional intelligence exists on the border of character. It's not the same as character, but it sits on the border of it. And while it's not the same as godliness or sin, it is a catalyst for godliness or sin. So good emotional intelligence can enable good patterns, and poor emotional intelligence can enable bad patterns. Let me give you some examples. Take the issue of empathy. Empathy is not inherently godly. To lack empathy is not sin. But we know that empathy, if you have empathy, you will find it a lot easier to obey Romans 12:15, to mourn with those who mourn and rejoice with those who rejoice. And if you lack empathy, it'll be easier to disobey it and not do that work. Take self-awareness. Some people are more thoughtful than others about themselves. Some are less thoughtful. But we know that if you have some kind of self-awareness, and we'll think about this in a bit, it will give you some better spiritual insights into yourself and into other people. And a lack of self-awareness may be an obstacle because you're just not aware of how you're acting or how you're behaving. So good emotional intelligence doesn't necessarily make us godly, but it can be a really good catalyst for good character. You can maybe compare it to sleep. I mean, you know, I don't think any of us would think that insomnia is sin or ungodly. But we know, like, if I'm not sleeping very well, it will tend to make me angry and irritable and impatient. And I think actually we could push this a little bit harder, because some of the leadership scandals that we have faced in recent years have a very clear element of emotional intelligence to them. I'm not excusing anyone's behavior, of course not. I did that talk on why leaders fail. So obviously I'm not excusing anyone's behavior, but there is clearly a big issue of emotional intelligence there, isn't there? There's clearly an issue of that is not simply about sin, but is more complicated. And maybe if he and others might have grown in that area, may have hindered and restrained some of the issues. And as a kind of counterexample, one of my great heroes, John Newton, I think was a very healthy man, actually, who exhibited very strong emotional intelligence and enabled him to have an impact. So I think this is very relevant for character, very useful for character. And you will be, you know, you will know very well, when you pass to people and you're dealing with people, you know that there are times when you're dealing with people and the issue you're dealing with is not simply sin or ungodliness. There's other stuff going on. There is a kind of lack of emotional maturity, a lack of emotional intelligence going on. Because you get people sometimes who are very godly in many ways. They love their Bibles. They love Jesus. And yet the way they behave lacks an awareness of the feelings of others, lacks relational skill, and it causes problems. So I think this is a really useful category for us. And I think we will find that if we're going to lead and pastor people longer term, the only way you can lead and pastor unhealthy people is by being healthy yourself. When we adopted kids, we were forced to go through a whole kind of process of self-evaluation and training. Because basically what they're trying to teach us to do is to be very healthy parents, because we're going to have kids who've had very difficult backgrounds. And we, if we're going to parent kids who are like that, we have to be extra healthy, extra reflective. And I don't think it's any different for pastors. Now, why don't you just turn to the person next to you? Have a think. Is emotional intelligence something you thought about much before? You know, how do you think it might be useful? Just 2 minutes with the person next to you. Something you thought about before, how do you think it might be useful? Okay. So now, what I'm going to do now, I'm going to throw out six different skills. Okay, three, this is not some kind of ultimate summary. Just six things which we could use to kind of strengthen our emotional intelligence. And each of these things needs loads more reflection and thought. So I'm not assuming we're kind of done this issue. I'm throwing out there, you can pursue something that you think, oh, actually, I should think about this a bit more. First thing is this, an awareness of my emotions. EI involves an awareness of myself. What I am not aware of in myself will do something with me, but what I am aware of, I can do something with. You know, someone gets really bad kind of back pain, you think, what's going on? Oh, actually, I'm actually really stressed. You know, that it will do something with you if you are not aware of it. And what I'm talking about here is being able to name what's going on underneath the surface. What's stressing me? Why? What am I insecure? I'm feeling quite insecure. Why am I feeling insecure? What are my fears here? In leadership, there is a lot of anxiety. There's a lot of stress. We're worried about many things. And if I'm not really aware of what's going on, it will drive my behavior and my words and my actions in a negative way. But diagnosis always de-escalates. And so if I'm able to diagnose what is going on, what I'm feeling, I will have some understanding of why I am feeling like this, what's going on inside of me. And when I see what's going on, I will be able to take responsibility for how I feel. Now, one of the aspects of emotional intelligence is the ability to restrain my emotions in an appropriate way. So know when how emotions should be expressed in particular circumstances, when they're functional and constructive. But I won't be able to do that if I don't actually know how I'm feeling. I kind of need to be aware of it. And so I need to be able to see a difference between a situation and how I'm reacting to that situation. And the more I'm able to do that, the more I will find that I will actually be a powerful presence and a calming influence around me. My leadership will be a non-anxious presence. One of the characteristics of domineering leaders is that they have very poor self-awareness. They're very unaware of how other people experience them and how they make other people feel. And if they are attuned to other people, they're only attuned to other people's feelings for the sake of manipulating them. And they're only astute at reading other people so that they can get them to do what they want them to do. But actually, they have very little understanding of how they impact other people because they're very actually unaware of what's going on inside of themselves. They don't really realize, you know, who they really are. So better self-awareness will help me to express my feelings in appropriate ways. I'll be able to think, do you know, actually, I'm actually really angry now. So let's just hold off sending that email. I'm really stressed out. So let's just park that decision a moment because I'm actually really stressed out. I'm being a bit intense at the moment. So I need to kind of go for a walk and watch an episode of West Wing or something. You know, I need to kind of de-escalate this situation because actually I'm not in my right mind. And I'll only act badly. So emotional self-awareness, really key, really, really important for us. And I think the more we can cultivate that in ourselves, the more our presence around others will be constructive and helpful and useful. Second thing. Now, this is a little bit personal, this one. Awareness of my dark side. I need to pay close attention to the dark side of my leadership. And this overlaps with sin and with fallenness and with other stuff. There's a whole mixture of stuff going on here. And there's a handout, the first handout on the, if you go past the points. There's got a box with a kind of dysfunctionality in leadership. Can you see those boxes? And basically, it's a model from the kind of psychology of personality disorders, and it looks at kind of dysfunctional, five different kinds of dysfunctional leadership. I'll quickly go, we'll have a chance to read through it in a moment by ourselves. But basically, five dysfunctional kind of types of leadership. So firstly, you've got the compulsive leader. Basically, a compulsive leader is a person who seeks control. They need to have control. They want everyone to obey the rules, to recognize their authority. They love order, they're rigid, they're controlling, they obsess over details. Compulsive leadership. Compulsive leader sees people as essentially chaotic and needing to be ordered. Then you have the narcissistic leader. Now, the narcissistic leader has a mixture of insecurity and hubris. They want everyone to applaud them and tell them that they are great. And they have an overdependence upon external admiration. The narcissistic leader will tend to, their approach to other people will be to use them, their objects to be used for their personal ends. So they see everything in relation to themselves. And so they find it hard to truly understand other people's feelings because everything is kind of related to them. Thirdly, we have the codependent leader. They're the person who just wants everyone to be happy with them. Something that their greatest fear is someone somewhere is angry with me and I need to sort it out. And so they suppress their emotion. That people often like them because they always agree. And they take responsibility for the feelings of others. So the codependent leader is motivated by appeasing others and need other people for their own peace. Fourthly, the paranoid leader. The paranoid leader basically sees people as threats who they need to be protected from. And they're underneath there's a lot of fear. Their greatest need is for everyone to be loyal and faithful to them. And their greatest fear is that people won't be loyal and faithful to them. So they're always worried someone's plotting against me somewhere. Fifthly, the passive aggressive leader. They're basically avoidant. So they underperform. They will resist demands from others. They just quietly just not do. Well, if you're a procrastinator, you're probably quite passive aggressive. In your style of leadership, you probably prefer to avoid confrontation. You're unclear in your communication. Just want to be left alone, to be able to get just everyone just leave me alone. I'll get on my thing, and so if you don't make any demands of me, I'll be okay. Now, what I'd love us to do, read through it for yourself and think, which two of these are you most like? So I am most like the narcissistic and the compulsive leader. Those are my innate things, and those are the areas where I've had to need to be sanctified. Okay, so that would be me. Okay, now you might read through it and think I don't have any of this, and then we'll pray for point one for you, a bit more self awareness of yourself, and if you just get someone else to tell, because they'll tell you actually what you're most like, so that will help. But just take 5 minutes, read through it. And then we'll just have, again, with your parents, just have a quick chat about. I'm not asking you to confess your deepest motives and problems, but just you might be able to say, I was struck by that. Okay, 5 minutes just to read through it, have a think where you're at. Okay, I know there's a lot to talk about there. One helpful comment here, just we're chatting about how maybe different bits of us can come out of different leadership scenarios. So maybe who we are in our family. And who we are in ministry might be a little bit different, and different sides of us can come out. That's worth being aware. I think the point here is not to discourage us, but make us aware. Because actually other people have to put up with us. And they have to live with this stuff in us. And actually, to be honest, they have to do it quite a lot. So actually there's a sense in which the more we're aware of this, the more helpful it can be. The other thing that's also important is that it's really important when we do this stuff with it, we don't weaponize it. So, as soon as someone's a bit vulnerable, in the situation, oh yeah, that's Andy, whatever, or, that's Tom. Blah, blah, blah. And so you need to be able to be careful who you do this with. And it's important, even as we talk now, we don't weaponize this with one another because that kills vulnerability. Mm-hmm. And vulnerability is a key to kind of process. But if you don't have a mentor, get a mentor and you could work with this a bit. This is material you could use. So there you are. Awareness of our dark side. Thirdly, third skill, differentiation. differentiation, as in different, but eation on the end. Okay. Differentiation. What is that? Anyone come across that concept before? No. Okay. Good.
Differentiation.
Different, and an eation. Yeah. It's written down. So ministry is basically about relationships. It's obviously intensely relational work. And that's what makes it simultaneously a joy and makes it hard. And so therefore, the ability to relate well is key, isn't it? Healthy relating, I mean, this is obvious, isn't it? But healthy relating is key to good relationship, to good leadership. The good leadership is about relationships and doing relationships. Now, key to healthy relating is this concept of differentiation. Okay, what do we mean by that? Differentiation is simply the ability to be fully yourself while fully connected to other people. To be fully yourself while also being fully connected to other people. It's about having healthy boundaries so that I know where I end and another person begins without that leading to disconnection. So a differentiated leader has relationships with people that are neither enmeshed nor detached. Okay, so what do we mean by enmeshment? Enmeshment, we mean that an enmeshed leader basically is unable to keep any emotional or mental space between themselves and other people. They're constantly pulled into the issues of other people, constantly burdened by the emotions of other people, constantly anxious about the opinion of other people. They're blown here and there by every wave of emotion and opinion around them. And so they're influenced, moved by others, and they're kind of quite regularly overwhelmed. And eventually it might also be quite highly empathetic, but that empathy can kind of destroy them. And enmeshed leader ends up being an anxious presence because they're tossed here and there by every wind of issue. But a differentiated leader has space between themselves and someone else. You know, it's the kind of thing when someone says, "You've made me angry." A differentiated leader can see this person is angry, and their anger is a response maybe to something that I have done. But I have not made them angry. They've made themselves angry in response to what I've done. I may well be guilty, but their anger is their emotion. And what they're doing, they're trying to enmesh me and say that their anger is all about me. So a differentiated leader can distinguish between the reactions and the emotions someone else is having and themselves and what's going on without kind of just saying, "Oh, well, that's your fault." And here we come on to the other side of things. A differentiated leader is not a detached leader. So you've got two ends of the spectrum. There's a little diagram on your handout there of enmeshment or detachment. And as I talk about this, you might think, you veer maybe more to one than the other. And in different relationships, you might veer more to one than the other. But a differentiated leader is clear on who they are and what their convictions are. They can see the emotions of another person as their emotions. But they don't have too much space between themselves and the other person. So the detached leader, as opposed to the enmeshed leader, stands alone. They're an asteroid, a satellite up in space, you know, far from the messiness of this grubby little world. They're completely unburdened by the emotions of other people. They are remote, austere, indifferent. They have little empathy. And so an enmeshed leader has an anxious presence, but a detached leader has a non-anxious absence. An enmeshed leader has an anxious presence, but a detached leader has a non-anxious absence. So it's a little bit of a tongue twister. The enmeshed leader has an anxious presence. The detached leader has a non-anxious absence. But the differentiated leader has a non-anxious presence. We should try and say that really quickly, shouldn't we? Has a non-anxious presence. So a differentiated leader can lead people to difficult places while still being connected to them. A differentiated leader can maintain caring connection even when people are trying to sabotage their efforts or thwarting them. A differentiated leader can communicate difficult topics without heat. They can pastor without needing to be needed or without becoming emotionally entwined in the people they're leading. They can accept disagreement with others but keep the relational connection and trust. I've found this very helpful for myself. It's a very simple concept. But you know, once you get your head around it, I think it's really helpful for understanding what's going on inside of me now? How am I relating? So your mourning, your pain, I understand it's not my pain, but I want to enter into your pain, and I do that freely. Yeah. And I can cry with you, but afterwards I can come away, and I'm able to see, I'm able to have some space between that. And of course, none of us are completely, you know, we're all a mess. So we're all kind of seesaw between these things. But I think the concept is helpful. Fourthly, understanding systems. Now, we talk about group dynamics, don't we? Well, groups have systems. And this is originally, it's a concept that's developed in family therapy. So we are not just a group of individuals. We have a system going on here. And in your staff teams, there's a system. Your church has a system where relationships form, and the way that people act and speak is affected. We are not simply a group of individuals, but we are molded and shaped in community. So there are power dynamics, there are relational dynamics, and leadership involves leading groups, doesn't it? So we deal with systems all the time. And so we need to cultivate an understanding of what is going on. What is the system? Now, normally you're much more aware of that when you first enter a context or a group. You can kind of see, this is what. But once you're embedded, you become part of the system. And so you become less aware of what goes on. So every system has a way of behaving. You know, who starts the fight? Who escalates the fight? Who retreats? Who makes jokes? Who is subversive? Who sulks? Who speaks? Who stays silent? How do people speak? Who has authority and power? Who doesn't? So if you take our conversation yesterday evening, you could analyze that as we present the vision. What's going on? Who spoke in the room? Who stayed silent? How were things spoken? Who had power in the room? How were things influenced and shaped? You could do that with your staff team. What is going on? What is embedded and unspoken and assumed? It's very difficult sometimes to do that. When you know, what's actually assumed amongst us? Who sits where? In a staff team meeting, who's always quiet and on the edges of things? Who dominates? Who makes the jokes? Everything is kind of people. Follow patterns and roles, don't they? And you will find that you act differently in different social systems. You know, who you are in your family. You know, in your family, there'll be a pattern. Who starts the argument and who tries to calm things down? Or there's an unspoken rule about how we do conflict around here. Or, who gets up and does stuff. And there'd be all kinds of things going on. And emotional intelligence, I think, is about being aware of that. And being able to speak into it, particularly to work with the dysfunctionalities. When is this not working very well? You know, who is being marginalized here? Who's exercising power in a way that isn't helpful, constructive? And when you are aware of what's going on, when I'm aware with my emotions, if I'm aware of what's going on, I can deal with issues that aren't just surface ones. I can think not just about, I think one of the key things in leadership is to think about not just what is being said, but how is it being said? What's the context in what it's being said? And as leaders, I think we're called to understanding and wisdom. And the more we can get that, the more we'll be able to lead systems in constructive and useful ways. Okay. 4 points, just two more to go. All right. Fifth one, conflict management. I'm going to spend a bit of time on this one because I think this is actually the ability to manage conflict is actually key for success. Relationships are about conflict. So it's a normal part of our world. It's not necessarily bad or necessarily good. It kind of depends. And this might sound strange, I think, to anyone who's kind of newer in ministry, but I think actually the way you deal with conflict may well define your ministry, for good and for bad, long term. And I don't just mean like, you know, the uber kind of, you know, supercharged conflict. I just mean the daily little differences. How do you deal with conflict? Now, you've got a handout. If you look at your handout, there's a picture with animals on. You see? And I think it's useful to kind of work out, how do I deal with conflict? And basically you can plot yourself along two axes of assertiveness or affirmation. So the bull is high in assertiveness, low in affirmation. It's like, you know, this is the way to do it. Let's charge up the hill. The owl is high in assertiveness, high in affirmation. Look, I think we should do this, but what do you think? You know, your view is important. Oh, you disagree with me. Okay, well, let's talk about this, because I think this is the best. It's got affirmation and assertiveness. The fox kind of just hedges his bets. Just be careful. The teddy bear, high in affirmation, low in assertiveness. Just cuddly, nice. Oh, no, it's all right. Be all right. Don't worry. Okay, I understand. The turtle just goes, just stays quiet. Now, the thing is, each one of us has a natural bent towards conflict. Where you go? Positive, warm, you know, yeah. A positive engagement. Don't know, anyone else? I can't think of another.
He's struggling with that one.
This is a horribly important.
Say nice things to people. Okay. Yeah. So actually, all of us have a natural tendency in conflicts, and how we deal, you know, with situations when there's some kind of disagreement, what we naturally do. And all of us have a second one, I think, which is when it comes high stress. So for me, I'm the owl, and when it gets high stress, I become the teddy bear. Okay, so if, you know, with my wife, if we start to have, like, I'll go da da da, and she'll go, no, da, da, and then I say, okay, let's try and make everything better. It's okay. Give me a hug. It'll be all right. And it's working out for yourself. Some people are actually the opposite. Some people get very stressed by conflict and they become bulls. You know, the worse it gets, the more assertive they become and the stronger they become. Let me say just a few things about it. Firstly, there's no one way of doing conflict that's right. There are different situations that call for different strategies. So if you're going to have a debate about what colour we should paint the church toilet, you probably just want to be a bit of a bull in that. Because you don't want to set up a committee and discuss this. Just make a decision. What coffee are you going to have? Just make a decision. But there's other situations where another strategy is much better. I'll come back to that. Secondly, there's a difference, as I said, between low stress, high stress. Know yourself a little bit. What's going on inside of you in these conflict scenarios? Thirdly, I think we can learn to use other styles that aren't so natural to us. So the turtle is very unlike, I'm not a turtle. But in ministry and in life, I have learned the value of being a turtle. Just leave it alone. Just leave it alone. Don't do anything with that. And actually, it's been really, really good strategy in certain situations. Just leave that person alone. Don't confront them. Don't do anything about it. But if that's always your default strategy, it's going to be a bit problematic, isn't it? So we need to have different gears. So if you think about it, last night there was conflict in this room. There was disagreement, okay, about what we should do. How did people act? Who was the turtle? Who kind of like, no, we've got to... Who was, well, let's have a discussion about who was the owl. Who was the fox? Who was the teddy bear? Oh, come on. You know. And it might be in the situation, you might flip. So, you know, you might start off as the bull, no. And then afterwards you feel a bit bad. So you kind of retreat. And you go, oh, no, I'm really sorry. I didn't mean to say it like that. The way we do conflict is really, really key. If we don't learn to do it well, that becomes really explosive and becomes very destructive. But if we do it well, it can be really productive. And it's one of those issues for us as Brits. We struggle with this because we're actually more like the Japanese than we are like other Europeans. We have a value system that prefers indirect communication. So we don't, you know, to say to someone, no, I just really disagree with what you're saying, is in most English contexts quite rude. I don't know for Colombians and Brazilians here how you experience us, but for Norwegians, who are married to, people just like super clear. Germans, super clear. Just kind of say what you think. Whereas Brits kind of hedge everything around. Oh, I'm not quite sure if I agree with you. And within conservative evangelical circles, that's often quite a high value, isn't it? Indirect conflict. So part of the training culture in the past has not been, if someone is, if you think a trainee or you think some staff member is not behaving appropriately or doing the right thing, what you would do is you'd slap them down. You'd do an indirect passive-aggressive humiliation of that individual in some way, rather than going to them and talking to them and saying, do you know what, actually, I just think you've got a bit of a problem with pride here. I just think, do I want to help you to grow in humility? Much better, much more biblical way of doing things, isn't it? But we're shaped by our culture and our culture's way of doing conflict. So we need to be aware of that. It's good to think about that. And it's good to understand other people. You know, my wife is more like the turtle. It was on the owl, and I'm thinking, no, but the owl's the best way of doing it. Look, come on, darling, let's sit down, let's talk about this. You can have your opinion. I can, you know, and I love you. And could you just say, I don't want to talk about it. Leave me alone. And I'm trying, you know, I'm handling that in a very poor way, in a very unconstructive way. So think through the way you do conflict. Why don't you just turn to the person next to you? Who do you think you are? Where do you go? Any thoughts on that? High and low. Okay, last one. Healthy cognitive habits. That's nice and snappy. Healthy cognitive habits. Last bit is taken a little bit from CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy. If you've ever done that or know people who do it, it's used for in the NHS and depression, for depression and anxiety. And it basically, CBT works with patterns of thought, and it works to unearth and discover dysfunctional habits of thought. So it basically works with the idea that, you know, the way I think, my mindset does a sliding tackle on my emotional life. And that these patterns of thought are often very unconscious and shape us. So I'll just run through some of these patterns of thought. So firstly, first pattern of thought, black and white thinking. Again, so that you've got a handout there, I should say, it should list them up for you. You go towards the back. So black and white thinking is an all or nothing, either or attitude. Things are either completely right or they're completely rubbish. It's brilliant or it's completely useless. My sermon is either amazing or it's terrible. My leadership is either perfect or I'm a complete failure. There's no maybes, there's only certainties. There's no grey, there's no nuance. If you're black and white and you're thinking, you tend to be quite rigid, it will lead to being a bit perfectionistic, and you probably have unrealistic expectations. How much do we think in black and white ways? Secondly, generalizing. Generalizing is when you make broad assumptions based on a trivial fact. Everyone thinks this. People always do that. Joe has said this, so everyone feels like this. Barbara did this, so it's basically all over. William doesn't like this, so no one likes it. It's generalizing from a fact to make it like a global idea. Thirdly, self-focusing and negative mind reading. You believe that there is a personal significance behind random events. So you be careful how you handle things like spiritual warfare and God's providence. You can jump to convoluted explanations for everything. There was one Christian girl in Christian leadership who I think had tremendous problems with this. And she was enmeshed in this relationship with a guy who she was obsessed with, but couldn't, clearly wasn't interested in her. But everything in her spiritual life revolved around that relationship. And she would read lots of stuff into what is going on. And that's quite an extreme example. And I think it done her in, actually. In Christian ministry, full-time Christian ministry. But actually, we can have more low-grade versions of that. Fourthly, exaggerated feelings. When my sensations and emotions are made more negative or meaningful than they are. You say, I feel absolutely awful. Really? Absolutely awful? Yeah, you feel bad. I am so low. Are you really that? Is it that low? I'm not saying use it on other people. You've got to be careful with that. But use it myself. I'm completely stressed. I can't cope. Well, you got up this morning, you had breakfast. You know, you took your kids to school. So you've got to be careful because it's basically negative self-talk and it will drive you into a ditch. Fifthly, catastrophizing, where you turn the run-of-mill negatives into catastrophes. My child's home late. Well, they must have been kidnapped. The numbers are low this Sunday. Well, the church is obviously dying. Ever feel that one? I didn't get positive feedback on my sermon, so it's obvious I can't preach. We catastrophize. And the other thing to say about these patterns of thought are, there are three volume controls on these thought patterns. Okay, first volume control. I think the question's on your. I think it's on your sheets. How personally do I take things? Is that on your sheets?
Yeah.
How pervasive is my distorted thinking? How permanent is it? The more personally I take things, the more pervasive it is. The more permanent it is, the bigger effect it's going to have on me. And what's helpful about some of this, you know, we come back to the earlier point. What I don't know will do something with me, but what I know about, I can do something with. And so being aware of this can help me. It doesn't stop me catastrophizing, but at least I'll be able, my child probably hasn't been kidnapped. Because I thought that five times before and they weren't. You know, you become more self-aware and you can restrain the reactions better. So, lots of stuff for us to grow in, lots of stuff for us to be making progress in.